Politicians win elections by arousing passion and commitment from voters, by motivating and persuading. This is not new. H.L. Mencken's 1918 book, In Defense of Women, noted, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed, and hence clamorous to be led to safety, by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, most of them imaginary." The threat of climate catastrophe, whether storms, droughts, rising seas, failed crops, or economic collapse, resonates with everyone. And this threat can be portrayed as both urgent, by invoking a recent deadly weather event, for instance, and yet distant enough so that a politician's dire predictions will be tested only decades after they've left office. Unfortunately, while climate science and associated energy issues are complicated, complexity and nuance don't lend themselves at all well to political messaging. So the science is jettisoned in favor of the science and simplified for use in the political arena, which allows the required actions to be portrayed simply as well. Just eliminate fossil fuels to save the planet. Of course, this isn't a climate-specific problem, and the electorate, which abhors a gray area, bears part of the blame. It's hard to rally the base with uncertainty. There would surely be less support for, say, promoting renewable energy sources if they were more realistically portrayed as a possible way to mitigate a possible future problem instead of an essential solution to an imminent crisis. And uncertainty can be a political weapon. Politicians on the right who deny even the basics that science has settled, that human influences have played a role in warming the globe, are not above exploiting climate science uncertainties, offering them as proof that the climate isn't changing after all. Politicians on the left find it inconvenient to discuss scientific uncertainties or the magnitude of the challenge in reducing human influences. Instead, they declare the science settled and label anyone who questions that conclusion a denier, lumping conscientious scientists advocating for less persuasion and more research in with those openly hostile to science itself. Some politicians have gone far beyond name-calling, brazenly attempting to undermine the scientific process. Two billionaire politicians, Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, whose goal was making the climate threat feel real, immediate, and potentially devastating to the business world, conspired with some scientists and others to produce a series of reports mischaracterizing the extreme emission scenario RCP 8.5 as business as usual, that is, a world without further efforts to rein in emissions. The reports were accompanied by a sophisticated campaign to infuse that notion into scientific conferences and journals. Those who seek to corrupt the scientific process in that way are playing the same game as the anti-science crowd they loudly decry. Fortunately, the deception is now being called out in leading scientific journals. Finally, it is standard practice to suggest that many of the politicians on the right who promulgate the idea of a climate change hoax are influenced by ties to industries negatively affected by restrictive environmental regulation. Alas, as the alternative energy industry grows, there is financial incentive for politicians to hype climate catastrophe as well. Science should not be partisan, but climate science's intersection with energy policy and politics all but guaranteed that it would become so. Scientific institutions. Trust in scientific institutions underpins our ability, and the ability of the media and politicians as well, to trust what is presented to us as the science. Yet when it comes to climate, those institutions frequently seem more concerned with making the science fit a narrative than with ensuring the narrative fits the science. We've already seen that the institutions that prepare the official assessment reports have a communication problem, often summarizing or describing the data in ways that are actively misleading. In the next chapter, we'll delve a bit further into how this happens. I won't belabor the point here. Other scientific institutions, or their leaders, have also been overwilling to persuade rather than inform. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, NASEM, is a private, nonprofit institution chartered by the U.S. Congress in 1863 to advise the nation. To quote from their website, "The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine are the nation's preeminent source of high-quality, objective advice on science, engineering, and health matters. The academies provide that advice largely through written reports sponsored by federal agencies. Some 200 reports are published each year, dealing with a great range of topics in science, engineering, medicine, and the societal issues associated with them. Academy's reports undergo an extensive authoring and review process. I know that process well, having led two Academy studies and reviewed the reports of several others, along with, for 6 years, overseeing all the Academy's report activities in engineering and the physical sciences, including several in energy, but none in climate science. This process does indeed result in reports that are almost always objective and of the highest quality. Unfortunately, as we've seen, their reviews of the national climate assessments, they don't write the assessments themselves, in 2014 and 2017/18 didn't quite meet that standard. On June 28, 2019, the presidents of the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine issued a statement affirming the scientific evidence of climate change. The sole paragraph dealing with the science itself read, "Scientists have known for some time, from multiple lines of evidence, that humans are changing Earth's climate, primarily through greenhouse gas emissions. The evidence on the impacts of climate change is also clear and growing. The atmosphere and the Earth's oceans are warming, the magnitude and frequency of certain extreme events are increasing, and sea level is rising along our coasts." Even given the need for brevity, this is a misleadingly incomplete and imprecise accounting of the state of climate science. It conflates human-caused warming with the changing climate in general, erroneously implying that human influences are solely responsible for these changes. It invokes certain extreme events while omitting the fact that most types, including those that pop most readily to mind when one reads the phrase extreme events, like hurricanes, show no significant trend at all. And it states that sea level is rising in a way that not only suggests that this, too, is solely attributable to human-caused warming, but elides the fact that the rise is nothing new. I'm quite sure that this personal statement issued by the presidents in a news release was not reviewed by the usual Academy's procedures. If it had been, its deficiencies would have been corrected. The statement, therefore, carries the weight of the Academy's name without being subject to its customary rigor. Ironically, the statement goes on to say the Academy's need to more clearly communicate what we know, which in this case, they didn't. When communication of climate science is corrupted like this, it undermines the confidence people have in what the scientific establishment says about other crucial societal issues, COVID-19 being the outstanding recent example. As Philip Handler, a prior president of the National Academy of Sciences, wrote in the 1980 editorial I mentioned in the introduction, "It is time to return to the ethics and norms of science so that the political process may go on with greater confidence. The public may wonder why we do not already know that which appears vital to decision, but science will retain its place in public esteem only if we steadfastly admit the magnitude of our uncertainties and then assert the need for further research. And we shall lose that place if we dissemble, or if we argue as if all necessary information and understanding were in hand. Scientists best serve public policy by living within the ethics of science, not those of politics." Scientists. This book's introduction described Stephen Schneider's false choice between being effective and being honest. But there are other factors that encourage climate researchers' monolithic portrayal of the science as settled, however vigorous their internal debates might be. Feynman closes his cargo cult speech by wishing the Caltech graduates the good luck to be somewhere where you are free to maintain the kind of integrity I have described, and where you do not feel forced by a need to maintain your position in the organization, or financial support, or so on, to lose your integrity. I know from experience that such institutional pressures are real. Whether you're working for the government, a corporation, or an NGO, there is a message to be adhered to. For academics, there's pressure to generate press and to secure funding through grants. There's also the matter of promotion and tenure. And there is peer pressure. More than a few climate contrarians have suffered public opprobrium and diminished career prospects for publicizing data that doesn't support the broken climate meme. Carl Wunsch, a prominent oceanographer from MIT, who has long urged scientists to be realistic in their portrayal of the science, has written about the pressures on climate scientists to produce splashy results. "The central problem of climate science is to ask what you do and say when your data are, by almost any standard, inadequate. If I spend 3 years analyzing my data, and the only defensible inference is that the data are inadequate to answer the question, how do you publish? How do you get your grant renewed? A common answer is to distort the calculation of the uncertainty, or ignore it altogether, and proclaim an exciting story that the New York Times will pick up. A lot of this is somewhat like what goes on in the medical business. Small, poorly controlled studies are used to proclaim the efficacy of some new drug or treatment. How many such stories have been withdrawn years later when enough adequate data became available? Scientists not involved with climate research are also to be faulted. While they're in a unique position to evaluate climate science's claims, they're prone to a phenomenon I call climate simple. The phrase blood simple, first used by Dashiell Hammett in his 1929 novel Red Harvest, describes the deranged mindset of people after a prolonged immersion in violent situations. Climate simple is an analogous ailment in which otherwise rigorous and analytical scientists abandon their critical faculties when discussing climate and energy issues. For example, the diagnosis was climate simple when one of my senior scientific colleagues asked me to stop the distraction of pointing out inconvenient sections of an IPCC report. This was an eyes-shut, fingers-in-the-ears position I've never heard in any other scientific discussion. What causes climate simple? Perhaps it is a lack of knowledge of the subject, or fear of speaking out, particularly against scientific peers. Or perhaps it is simple conviction, born more of faith in the proclaimed consensus than of the evidence presented. Leo Tolstoy's 1894 philosophical treatise, The Kingdom of God is Within You, contains the following thought: the most difficult subjects can be explained to the most slow-witted man if he has not formed any idea of them already, but the simplest thing cannot be made clear to the most intelligent man if he is firmly persuaded that he knows already, without a shadow of doubt, what is laid before him. Whatever its cause, climate simple is a problem. Major changes in society are being advocated, and trillions will be spent, all based on the findings of climate science. That science should be open to intense scrutiny and questioning, and scientists should approach it with their usual critical objectivity, and they shouldn't have to be afraid when they do. Activists and non-governmental organizations, NGOs. My inbox fills with fundraising appeals from such organizations as 350.org, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and the Natural Resources Defense Council. If you believe there is a climate emergency, have built an organization on that premise, and rely upon your donors' continuing commitment to the cause, projecting urgency is crucial. Hence statements like, "The climate crisis is immense. We must be daring and courageous in response," from the 350.org website, or, "Climate change is one of the most devastating problems that humanity has ever faced, and the clock is running out," from the UCS website. It's hardly in your best interest to tell your donors that the climate shows no sign of being broken, or that projections of future disasters rely on models of dubious validity. The media tend to accord NGOs an authoritative stance, but these are also interest groups with their own climate and energy agendas, and they are powerful political actors who mobilize supporters, raise money, run campaigns, and wield political power. For many, the climate crisis is their entire raison d'etre. They also have to worry about being outflanked by more militant groups. I have no problem with activism, and the efforts of NGOs have made the world better in countless ways. But distorting science to further a cause is inexcusable, particularly with the complicity of those scientists who serve on their advisory boards. The public. Fear of extreme weather events is understandable, and concerns about changes in climate are as old as humanity. Short-term weather events, storms, floods, droughts, have stressed and challenged societies, while changes extending over decades induced mass migrations or even destroyed entire civilizations. For example, repeated crop failures devastated communities in the southwest United States during the 25-year-long Great Drought about 750 years ago. The notion that our behavior might be causing such calamities is also as old as humanity, as is the hope that we might avoid the worst of climate disasters by changing our behavior. Leviticus 26:3-4 promises regular rain, very important in the Middle East, and its ensuing benefits in return for doing the right thing. "If ye walk in my statutes, and keep my commandments, and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit." We like to think public attitudes toward climate today are more discerning, but they still mostly involve unquestioning acceptance of wisdom handed down from on high. As around the world, most citizens in America are not scientists, and the educational system does not deliver much in the way of scientific literacy to the wider public. Most people do not have the ability to examine the science themselves, and they have neither time nor the inclination to do so. Many increasingly get their information from social media, where it is far too easy to promote misinformation or disinformation. And in my experience, people tend to believe and trust their chosen media in areas outside their expertise. Michael Crichton, the best-selling author of The Andromeda Strain and Jurassic Park, lived near Caltech and was a prominent member of Pasadena's extended intellectual community until his death in 2008. Crichton, who was a physician before he became a writer, was an outspoken advocate for scientific integrity, and he looked askance at the public presentation of climate science. His 2004 novel, State of Fear, deals with that subject. Crichton's conversations with Caltech professor Murray Gell-Mann, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who was one of the first researchers to hypothesize quarks, led him to describe the Gell-Mann amnesia effect. You open the newspaper to an article on some subject you know well. In Murray's case, physics. In mine, show business. In any case, you read with exasperation or amusement the multiple errors in a story, and then turn the page to national or international affairs, and read as if the rest of the newspaper was somehow more accurate about Palestine than the baloney you just read. You turn the page and forget what you know. It certainly doesn't help that, at this point, even attempting a discussion of the science is to enter a political minefield. When I tell people some of the things the assessment reports really say about climate, many immediately ask whether I was a Trump supporter. My reply is that I was not, and that, as a scientist, I have always supported truth. As a scientist, I'm disappointed that so many individuals and organizations in the scientific community are demonstrably misrepresenting the science in an effort to persuade rather than inform. But you also should be concerned as a citizen. In a democracy, voters will ultimately decide how society responds to a changing climate. Major decisions made without full knowledge of what the science says and doesn't say, or, even worse, on the basis of misinformation, are much less likely to lead to positive outcomes. COVID-19 offered a sobering illustration of this, and it's as true for climate and energy as it is for pandemics. 11. Fixing the broken science. In early 2017, it had been 3 years since the American Physical Society workshop that opened my eyes to problems with the science. I had been tracking the misrepresentation of climate science by the media and politicians ever since, and I was freshly irked by the misleading presentation of hurricane data in the 2014 National Climate Assessment that I had stumbled upon 6 months earlier, as I described in Chapter 6. I was increasingly convinced that the science needed a red team exercise, a concept I'd already been refining for a few years. In such an exercise, a group of scientists, the Red Team, would be charged with rigorously questioning one of the assessment reports, trying to identify and evaluate its weak spots. In essence, a qualified adversarial group would be asked, "What's wrong with this argument?" And, of course, the Blue Team, presumably the report's authors, would have the opportunity to rebut the Red Team's findings. Red Team exercises are commonly used to inform high-consequence decisions, such as testing national intelligence findings, or validating complex engineering projects, like aircraft or spacecraft. They're also common in cybersecurity. Red Teams catch errors or gaps, identify blind spots, and often help to avoid catastrophic failures. In essence, they're an important part of a prudent, belt-and-suspenders approach to decision-making. Note that the use of red and blue is traditional in the military, where these exercises originated. It has nothing to do with U.S. politics. A red team review of a climate assessment report could bolster confidence in the assessment, as well as demonstrate the robustness, or lack thereof, of its conclusions. It would both underscore the reliability of the science that stands up to its scrutiny and highlight for non-experts uncertainties or inconvenient points that had been obscured or downplayed. In short, it would improve and bolster the science with science. Of course, both the UN's IPCC and the U.S. government claim that their respective assessment reports are authoritative because they're already subject to rigorous peer review before publication. So why call for yet another level of review? The most direct answer is that, as the previous chapters of this book have highlighted, these reports have some egregious failures, and an important reason for those failures is the way the reports are reviewed. Let me explain. Science is a body of knowledge that grows by testing, one step building on the next. If each step is solid, researchers can get to some amazing places pretty quickly, like rapid vaccine development or modern information technology. To know that a researcher has produced a sound new piece of knowledge, other researchers scrutinize, and often challenge, results from experiments or observations, or formulate new models and theories. Have the measurements been done properly? Were there adequate controls on the experiments? Are the results consistent with prior understanding? What are the reasons for an unexpected result? Satisfactory answers to questions like those are the hurdle for accepting new results into the ever-growing body of scientific knowledge. The peer review of scientific journals is one mechanism for scrutinizing and challenging new research results. In that process, individual independent experts analyze and criticize a draft paper describing the results. The author's responses to those criticisms are adjudicated by a third-party referee, who will then recommend publication, or not, to the journal's editor, or suggest how the paper should be revised. I have participated in many such peer reviews over the course of my 45-year scientific career, sometimes as an author, sometimes as a reviewer, sometimes as a referee, and a few times as an editor. I can tell you from those experiences that peer review can improve a paper's presentation and will usually catch major errors, but it is far from perfect, and in no sense guarantees the correctness of what gets published. Independent reproduction or refutation of the results by other researchers conducting their own studies is a much stronger guarantee of correctness. That eventually happens for all important findings. But an assessment report is not a research article. In fact, it's a very different sort of document with a very different purpose. Journal papers are focused presentations written by experts for experts. In contrast, assessment authors must judge the validity and importance of many diverse research papers, and then synthesize them into a set of high-level statements meant to inform non-experts. So an assessment report's story really matters, as does the language used to tell it, especially for something as important as climate. The processes for drafting and reviewing the climate science assessment reports do not promote objectivity. Government officials from scientific and environmental agencies, who might themselves have a point of view, nominate or choose the authors, who are not subject to conflict of interest constraints. That is, an author might work for a fossil fuel company or for an NGO promoting climate action. This increases the chances of persuasion being favored over information. A large group of volunteer expert reviewers, including, for the National Climate Assessment, a group convened by the National Academies, reviews the draft. But unlike the peer review of research papers, disagreements among reviewers and lead authors are not resolved by an independent referee. The lead author can choose to reject a criticism simply by saying, "We disagree." The final versions of assessments are then subject to government approval through an interagency process for the U.S. government and often contentious meetings of experts and politicians for the IPCC. And, a very key point, the IPCC's summaries for policymakers are heavily influenced, if not written, by governments that have interests in promoting particular policies. In short, there are many opportunities to corrupt the objectivity of the process and product. I presented the Red Team idea in early February 2017 at the 4th Santa Fe Conference on Global and Regional Climate Change, a forum that traditionally embraced a diversity of viewpoints. At the end of my pitch, I asked the few hundred people in the room for a show of hands and was surprised at the favorable reaction. Most of the audience of experts thought that such an exercise could be useful if executed well. Perhaps those researchers in the trenches were more uncomfortable than I'd realized with the way their science was being portrayed to non-experts. In any event, their endorsement emboldened me to take the idea to a wider audience. The inaugural March for Science was to take place on April 22nd, Earth Day, 2017, with rallies and marches in 600 cities around the world. Since one of the march's goals was to call for evidence-based policy in the public's best interest, I thought it would be a good moment to make an important point about climate science and how it's communicated to non-experts. The moment seemed especially opportune since a major U.S. government assessment, the first part of NCA 2018, the Climate Science Special Report, or CSSR, was scheduled to be released in the fall. 2 days before the March for Science, the Wall Street Journal published an opinion piece in which I advocated for a red team review of climate science assessments. I used NCA 2014's misleadingly alarming description of hurricane data to illustrate the need for such a review and outlined how it could be carried out. My opinion piece drew almost 750 online comments from readers, the great majority of them supportive. Some in the Trump administration also took notice, and given the administration's reluctance to publicly accept even the basics of climate understanding, their interest in a climate science red team engendered some very strong objections to the proposal. Most prominent were pieces published in late July 2017 by John Holdren, the Obama administration's science advisor who had been the sponsor of the CSSR, and one published the following week by Eric Davidson, president of the American Geophysical Union, and Marcia McNutt, president of the National Academy of Sciences. Their essential point was that a red team exercise was superfluous since climate research and the assessment reports were already peer-reviewed. As Davidson and McNutt put it, "If the idea is to have the red team poke holes in the mainstream scientific community's, the blue team, consensus on climate change, it discounts that such challenges have already been applied thousands of times while that consensus was gradually developed." Holdren's language was more pointed. "Some proponents may believe, naively, that such a ragtag process could unearth flaws in mainstream climate science that the rigorous, decades-long scrutiny of the global climate science community through multiple layers of formal and informal expert peer review has somehow missed." It's telling that neither article addressed the NCA 2014 misrepresentation of hurricane data that I had highlighted, nor explained how it had survived the decades-long scrutiny of multiple layers of formal and informal expert peer review. That's especially disappointing, since we scientists are trained to focus on specifics. Instead, the opinion pieces offered only vague and anodyne assurances of the rigor with which the reports are written and reviewed. Of course, as I've already noted, while the research contained in them might indeed be subject to the type of peer review the public expects of scientific findings, the report's summaries and conclusions are not, and the hurricane example was only one of many report errors and misrepresentations, some of which I've described in this book's earlier chapters. As administration interest in a red team review continued through mid-2019, there were further objections from non-scientist politicians who have been misled into believing that the science is settled. On March 7, 2019, Senator Schumer, together with Senators Carper, Reid, Van Hollen, Whitehouse, Markey, Schatz, Smith, Blumenthal, Shaheen, Booker, Stabenow, Klobuchar, Hassan, Merkley, and Feinstein, introduced Senate Bill S.729 to prohibit the use of funds to federal agencies to establish a panel, task force, advisory committee, or other effort to challenge the scientific consensus on climate change and for other purposes. Although the bill never went anywhere, and it certainly wasn't the first time Congress has attempted to stop an administration from doing something, I confess to being shocked. An effort to challenge the scientific consensus could easily include many climate science research studies, and enshrining a certain scientific viewpoint as an inviolable consensus is hardly the role of government, at least in a democracy. I can't imagine Congress trying to do such a thing for any other important field of research, say COVID-19 therapies. And as a student of history, I found the bill uncomfortably reminiscent of a 1546 decree by the Council of Trent that attempted to suppress challenges to church doctrine. Some human behaviors are timeless, even as we suppose modern times to be so enlightened. I still believe that a red team review is an important tool that should be called upon to fix the assessment report process. But the way those assessments are communicated through the media also needs to be improved. In February 2018, after the National Academies established a climate communications initiative, I organized 34 other Academies members to author and send a letter urging that the initiative remain true to the Academy's stated stance of informing rather than persuading and of avoiding advocacy. We also urged that the Academies adopt a set of principles that would help ensure their communications on climate were transparent, complete, and unbiased. The Academy's presidents, all of whom I know personally, responded in a polite email to me on February 21, 2018. We thank you and the other signatories to this letter for taking the time to provide this thoughtful input. We agree that the new Climate Communications Initiative must avoid advocacy, adopt guidelines for CCI material, and establish a review mechanism. We will share your letter with the advisory committee members so that it may inform their deliberations, and let them know that they may reach out to you or other signatories for clarification or further input as they undertake their task. I never heard from the advisory committee, but perhaps the public and decision makers would find better use for such principles, which can help them to approach climate news more critically. You might think it's almost impossible for a non-expert to know what, or who, to believe when it comes to climate science. But even if you're not willing or able to invest too much time in ferreting out the facts, it's still pretty easy to watch for a few red flags that should trigger skepticism. Here's what to look for. Anyone referring to a scientist with the pejoratives denier or alarmist is engaging in politics or propaganda, and using the term climate change without distinguishing between natural and human causes signals a, perhaps deliberate, sloppiness in thinking. Many an article that purports to be about how humans have broken the climate or how we must reduce our emissions to fix it is nevertheless filled with examples of climate trends that are not attributable to, or fixable by, humans. Any appeal to the alleged 97% consensus among scientists is another red flag. The study that produced that number has been convincingly debunked, and in any event, nobody has ever specified exactly what those 97% of scientists are supposed to be agreed upon. That the climate is changing? Sure, count me in. That humans are influencing the climate? Absolutely, I'm there. That we're already seeing disastrous weather impacts and face an even more catastrophic future? Not at all obvious, for reasons I hope you understand, having read this far. Confusing weather and climate is another danger sign. 1 year's bad weather does not make for a changing climate. Climate is determined over decades. And a headline might say, most active storm season in 30 years. But if it happened before, when human influences were much weaker, natural variability must play a major role. Omitting numbers is also a red flag. Hearing that sea level is rising sounds alarming, but much less so when you're told it's been going up at less than 30 centimeters, 1 foot, per century, for the past 150 years. When numbers are included, omission of uncertainty estimates is another thing to watch out for in non-expert discussions of climate science, as has been recognized by at least one prominent journalist. Yet another common tactic is quoting alarming quantities without context. A headline that reads, "Oceans are warming at the same rate as if 5 Hiroshima bombs were dropped in every second," does indeed sound scary, particularly as it invokes nuclear weapons. But if you read further into that article, you learn that ocean temperatures are rising at only 0.04 degrees Celsius, 0.07 degrees Fahrenheit, per decade. And a basic science refresher would tell you that the Earth absorbs sunlight and radiates an equal amount of heat energy, equivalent to 2,000 Hiroshima bombs each second. It's pretty easy to scare people in the service of persuasion if you don't give any numerical context. Non-expert discussions of climate science also often confuse the climate that has been, observations, with the climate that could be, model projections under various scenarios. Chapters 3 and 4 have shown just how uncertain climate projections are, so watch out for the story that got onto the front page because it predicts a coming apocalypse based on models, and wordings in press coverage such as might be, could possibly be, as much as, and cannot be ruled out, are more signals of our ignorance than they are of prophecies of doom. At the very least, worst and best cases should be presented, though as I've discussed, readers should be particularly wary of worst-case scenarios described as business as usual. Anyone can, and should, read coverage of climate science with these red flags in mind. Checking on the consistency, or inconsistency, of coverage among various mass media outlets can help put a climate news story in context. Broadcast media is poorly suited for this, as their stories are brief and tuned to sound bites. Beware particularly of weather presenters who have morphed into climate and weather presenters. Reporting on 30-year changes does not exactly qualify as breaking news. Print and online news media is better, with the exception of the headlines. If you have time, Checking up on what you've read in the media by looking at the primary research cited is a good next step. Summaries of original research papers are available from the journals in which they appear, and for a particularly important piece of research, the paper itself is sometimes available online without charge. There are also a few blogs that seriously and consistently cover recent climate science. On the consensus side, Real Climate, realclimate.org, is worth looking at, while Judith Curry's site, Climate Etc., judithcurry.com, hosts serious discussions from a non-consensus point of view. But there's nothing like going directly to the data, which is, in the end, the arbiter of all science. Climate data is readily available online from the U.S. government, for example, from the EPA at www.epa.gov/climate-indicators and NOAA at www.noaa.gov/climate. So if you read a story about sea level rise, hurricanes, or average temperatures and want to dig a bit deeper, doing so requires only an internet connection and a sense of what questions might offer insight. Hopefully something any reader of this book has by now. Part 2. The response. Scientists aren't fortune tellers. There's no crystal ball that tells us how to, or even whether we'll need to, keep our planet safe from any given natural or human-caused climate problem that might arise. What we do have is our data, as imperfect as it is, and our ability to apply critical thinking and problem-solving skills to use that data to identify, or even anticipate, problems and come up with solutions. Lots of people have lots of different ideas about what those solutions might be. You've probably heard at least a few. At one extreme, we could undertake a moonshot to completely eliminate human greenhouse gas emissions within the next several decades, as is advocated by many governments, the UN, and virtually every NGO. At the other extreme, we could carry on with business as usual, taking the position that the climate is pretty insensitive to human influences, and that we'll be able to adapt to any changes that do occur. There are many things we could do to reduce human influences on the climate, though they wouldn't necessarily stop the climate from changing. That could discussion is mostly about science and technology, since we'd need to know how the climate would change absent human influences, and whether what we did would make a significant beneficial difference. The could question is very different from the question of, what should we do? Any discussion of how the world should respond to a changing climate is best informed by scientific certainties and uncertainties. But it's ultimately a discussion of values, one that weighs development, environment, and intergenerational and geographical equities in light of imperfect projections of future climates. And the could and should questions are different still from asking, what will we do? Answering that involves assessing the realities of politics, economics, and technology development. Indeed, the simple truth is that there are many things the world could do, and perhaps even should do, such as eliminating poverty, but which it will not do for various reasons. Importantly, making a judgment about will is not at all the same as stating an opinion about should. I was asking myself those could, should, and will questions in 2004 when I left my job as professor and provost at Caltech to become BP's chief scientist and begin a serious study of energy technologies beyond petroleum. I soon understood that I didn't have anything enlightening to say about the should question. My value judgments in such complex matters were not especially better than anyone else's, and I'm not a philosopher or ethicist. But within a year or so, by framing the issues clearly for non-experts and setting forth the advantages and drawbacks of various response strategies, I began contributing usefully to the could and will questions. That work came naturally to me, as it involved gathering, analyzing, and presenting data with scientific dispassion and was little different from what I had been doing in government advising. I have been working on the could question for the past 15 years now, and laying out the big picture in innumerable public presentations. The various assessment reports from the UN's IPCC urge that the world should, actually must, reduce greenhouse gas emissions promptly to prevent the worst impacts of human-caused climate change. And those same reports urge that mitigation of emissions, largely of energy-related carbon dioxide, should be accomplished by transitioning to low-carbon energy sources and agricultural practices, and by using less energy and food, conservation. The general goal has become to get to net zero carbon by mid-century. While in principle there are no absolute barriers to such reductions, multiple scientific, technical, economic, and social factors combine to make it highly implausible that the world will make them. Fortunately, not only is it far from certain that a climate disaster is pending, as we've seen in the first section of this book, but we have other strategies for responding to changes in climate, in particular adaptation and geoengineering. So here's my high-level view of the context for society's response. Keeping human influences on the climate below levels deemed prudent by the UN and many governments would require that global carbon dioxide emissions, which have been rising for decades, vanish sometime in the latter half of this century. Emissions reductions would have to take place in the face of strongly growing energy demand driven by demographics and development, the dominance of fossil fuels, and the current drawbacks of low emissions technologies. These barriers, combined with the uncertainty and vague nature of future climate impacts, mean that the most likely societal response will be to adapt to a changing climate, and that adaptation will very likely be effective. Let me take you through the data and analyses that support my view. 12. The chimera of carbon-free. In October 2004, I was sitting in a large conference hall in Kyoto, Japan, as a participant in the first Science and Technology in Society Forum. Mr. Koji Omi, a former Japanese Minister of Science and Technology, had convened this global gathering of scientists, technologists, business executives, policymakers, and media to discuss the roles that science and technology might play in addressing global problems. The changing climate was foremost among them. The STS Forum has since become an annual event, which I have attended in most recent years. I'm also a director of its American associates. Meetings like these are an excellent way to get a sense of what's happening around the world at the intersection of science, technology, and policy. My jet-lagged thoughts drifted away from the plenary presentations to the problem of how to talk to non-experts about reducing carbon dioxide's influence on the climate. Virtually all of the policy discussions focused on mitigating emissions, but it's the concentration of the gas in the atmosphere that influences the climate. There seemed to be a widespread lack of understanding of how emissions impact that concentration. Unfortunately, as I discussed in Chapter 3, that simple bit of science greatly increases the challenge of reducing human influences. The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere grows by roughly half of the amount emitted each year. If the current concentration is 415 ppm, emitting 37 billion tons of CO2, as we currently do each year, will increase that concentration by about 2 ppm. But the concentration is the result of cumulative emissions, and as we saw earlier, the CO2 we've added to the atmosphere doesn't go away when we stop emitting it. Emissions accumulate in the atmosphere and remain there for centuries as they are slowly absorbed by plants and the oceans. Modest reductions in emissions will only delay, but not prevent, the rise in concentration. So just how plausible was it that global CO2 emissions could be reduced enough to stabilize, never mind reduce, human influences, whatever their impact, within the coming decades? I returned to London from Kyoto determined to find out, and to present my findings simply for others. About a year later, I understood the science and the societal challenges well enough to see that a straightforward synthesis of a handful of basic facts led directly to the conclusion that even stabilizing human influences was so difficult as to be essentially impossible. Saying that directly and publicly while I was working for BP, and later the Obama Department of Energy, would probably have gotten me fired. But I was able to reconcile my organizational responsibilities with my scientific integrity by simply organizing and presenting the data and letting others follow the arrows for themselves. I finally published the essence of my 2005 analysis as a New York Times op-ed in November 2015, about a month before the Paris meeting where the world's countries were to pledge to reduce their emissions through 2030. The main points are quite simple. According to the IPCC, just stabilizing human influences on the climate would require global annual per capita emissions of CO2 to fall to less than 1 ton by 2075, a level comparable to today's emissions from such countries as Haiti, Yemen, and Malawi. For comparison, 2015 annual per capita emissions from the United States, Europe, and China were respectively about 17, 7, and 6 tons. Energy demand increases strongly and universally with rising economic activity and quality of life. Global demand is expected to grow by about 50% through mid-century as most of the world's people improve their lot. Fossil fuels supply 80% of the world's energy today and remain the most reliable and convenient means of meeting growing energy demand. The energy supply infrastructure of electric generating plants, transmission lines, refineries, and pipelines changes slowly for unavoidable structural reasons. Developed countries would certainly have to reduce their emissions, but even if those were to halve, and per capita emissions of the developing world grew only to those of today's lower-emitting developed countries, annual global emissions would still increase by mid-century. The tension between emissions reductions and economic development is complicated by uncertainties in how the climate will change under human and natural influences, and how those changes will affect natural and human systems. All else being equal, it might be a good thing to eliminate, or even just reduce, CO2 emissions. But all else isn't equal, so decisions must balance the cost and efficacy of mitigation measures against the certainties and uncertainties in climate science. And where your interests come out in that balancing act will depend in part upon what country you're in, how wealthy you are, and how much you care about, or whether you are a member of, the 40% of humanity that doesn't have access to adequate energy. I had been out of the government for 4 years in December 2015 when politicians and activists from 194 countries came together in Paris and agreed to limit human influences on the climate sufficiently to keep the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. A fact sheet released by the Obama White House shortly after that 21st Conference of Parties, COP21, stated, "The agreement sets a goal of keeping warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, and for the first time agrees to pursue efforts to limit the increase in temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. It also acknowledges that in order to meet that target, countries should aim to peak greenhouse gas emissions as soon as possible." Take a moment to read that again, carefully. When you do, you'll probably realize that there are a few unstated assumptions. One is that there's an agreed-upon temperature baseline from which to measure warming, and that it's defined within 0.5 degrees Celsius. Otherwise, we couldn't distinguish between 1.5 degrees Celsius and 2.0 degrees Celsius of warming. As you can see by looking back at Figure 1.1, if the baseline were the temperature in 1910, the world has already warmed by about 1.3 degrees Celsius. Whereas if the baseline were the average from 1951 to 1980, the zero line of that graph, the warming today would be 0.9 degrees Celsius, or 0.4 degrees Celsius smaller. Adopting a reference further back in time, say during the Little Ice Age around 1650, would mean even more apparent warming has already occurred, even as the world has prospered. Or perhaps we should choose a baseline from the medieval warm period around 1000 AD, which would mean the warming to date would be only about 0.4 degrees Celsius. See Figure 1.8. In fact, the temperature from which we're supposed to judge future warming is ambiguous, with the IPCC reports usually measuring relative to the latter half of the 19th century and the Paris Agreement advocating a baseline of pre-industrial values. Without clarity on this point, future politicians and policymakers could declare either victory or failure, as might be convenient at the time. Another assumption in the statement is that greenhouse gas emissions alone determine warming, and that we know how the climate will respond to them to within 25%, the precision required for our projections to distinguish the difference between warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius and 2 degrees Celsius. In fact, as discussed in Chapter 4, the climate's response to greenhouse gases is so uncertain that if we thought our emissions had been reduced enough to keep us safe at a warming of 2 degrees Celsius, the actual temperature might rise anywhere between 1 degree Celsius and 3 degrees Celsius. And the newest generation of models is even more uncertain, as we've also seen in Chapter 4. A third assumption is that warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.0 degrees Celsius will be net detrimental. In fact, many analyses suggest that a warming of less than 2 degrees Celsius is likely to have a small net positive economic impact, thanks to improved agricultural conditions and reduced heating costs in the temperate northern latitudes. And, as we've seen in Chapter 9, warming of 2 to 5 degrees Celsius, 3.6 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit, is projected to have little net economic impact over time. The Yale economist William Nordhaus first articulated the notion of a guardrail of about 2 degrees Celsius warming in the 1970s, work for which he would later be awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. But it is Hans Joachim Schneeberger, a physicist turned climate scientist, who is known as the father of the 2 degrees limit, for his unceasing promotion of that idea, especially across Europe. Some dozen years before 1.5 degrees Celsius became fashionable, I had a chat with Schneeberger during which I asked him, why 2 degrees Celsius, and not 1.5 or 2.5 or whatever? His response was something like, 2 degrees Celsius is about right, and it's an easy number for politicians to remember. Evidently, politicians' memories have improved during the last decade. Each of the assumptions in the Obama White House statement is dubious, if not just plain wrong, at least according to the science presented in the assessment reports and discussed in Part 1 of this book. But even if they're all correct, there is still the bottom line assumption that the world could reduce emissions enough to keep the warming below 2 degrees Celsius. Unfortunately, scientific, technological, and societal realities make that the shakiest assumption of the lot. In fact, according to the UN's IPCC, if the goal is to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius, global carbon dioxide emissions must vanish by 2075. If the goal is a rise of no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, this date becomes 2050, just 30 years from now. In other words, to achieve the stated Paris goals, the world must almost completely forswear fossil fuels within the next 30 to 50 years. Carbon capture schemes that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere can create negative emissions, so fossil fuel use wouldn't have to vanish entirely. I'll discuss those schemes and their feasibility in Chapter 14. But how realistic is it to believe that net global emissions can be eliminated within 30 to 50 years? Fossil fuels aren't burned just because. They provide the energy that's essential to developed and developing societies. And the world will need much more energy in the coming decades, in part because of demographics. Today's global population of just under 8 billion will grow to over 9 billion by mid-century, with virtually all of that growth occurring outside the developed world. That last detail is important because the economic betterment of most of humanity in the coming decades will drive energy demand even more strongly than population growth. Figure 12.1 shows the trajectories of annual per capita energy consumption for the four decades between 1980 and 2017, plotted against annual per capita GDP for some representative developed and developing countries and for the world as a whole. People in every developing country, including China, India, Mexico, and Brazil, consume more energy as their economies grow. They build infrastructure, ramp up industrial activities, demand more food, electricity, transportation, and so on. People in developed countries show a high but slow-growing energy demand, with differences among them depending upon the nature of their economic activity, their infrastructure, and their climate, because of heating and cooling needs. Large energy-producing countries like Canada, the U.S., and Australia show relatively outsized energy demand. Perhaps the most salient point to be gleaned here is that there are only about 1.3 billion people in the developed countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, that make up the upper portion of this chart, with some 6.5 billion people in the lower portion, increasing their energy use as they become better off. Combined, the drivers of population and development are expected to grow energy demand by about 50% through 2050. Figure 12.2 shows projections by the U.S. government's Energy Information Agency. The upper panel shows that growth will be strongest in Asia, with smaller and slower growth in the rest of the world. The lower panel shows that fossil fuels provide about 80% of the world's energy today, as they have for many prior decades, and that this dominance is projected to persist through mid-century under today's policies, although a strong growth in renewable sources like wind and solar will decrease the share of the world's energy provided by fossil fuels to about 70%. Remember, because of carbon dioxide's long lifetime in the atmosphere, it's cumulative CO2 emissions, the total amount emitted over time, that determine the concentration, and hence human influences on the climate. Figure 12.3 shows those cumulative emissions. The challenge is to flatten this steeply rising curve in the face of growing energy demand. You can also see that cumulative emissions to date have been dominated by today's developed countries. Because there are 5 times as many people developing as there are developed, the total emissions from the developed and developing worlds are now just about equal. But the very different growth rates of these 2 worlds have some sobering implications. First, over the course of this century, cumulative emissions, that is, the total amount emitted, from the developing world will be larger than those from the developed world. And under current trends, every 10% reduction that the developed world makes in its emissions, a reduction it has barely managed in 15 years, will offset less than 4 years of growth in the developing world. Finally, to give you a sense of the growth in emissions expected as the developing world improves itself, if nothing changed except that India's per capita emissions grew to be equal to those today of, say, Japan, one of the lowest emitting of the developed countries, global emissions would increase by more than 25%. These fundamental trends of demography and development show that eliminating global energy-related CO2 emissions within some 50 years would require an enormous transformation of the world's energy system. The world's governments expect to begin that transformation to a net-zero world through the Paris Agreement. Developed countries pledged to cut their emissions by individually determined amounts, intended nationally determined contributions, or INDCs, by 2020, 2025, and finally 2030, while the developing countries pledged to make best efforts to moderate growth in their emissions and expand renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar. Progress under the agreement is being reviewed every 5 years, beginning in 2020, with each country self-reporting its accomplishments. The phrase self-reporting likely raised your eyebrows on its own, but the agreement also has no enforcement mechanism and is non-binding, as the Trump administration demonstrated in November 2020 when it withdrew the U.S., and the Biden administration demonstrated again by initiating the process to rejoin as one of its first official acts in January 2020. Beyond their pledges of emissions reductions, the developed countries are also expected to contribute to the Green Climate Fund to help the developing countries moderate their own emissions through investments in carbon-light energy projects. The fund's stated goal has been to grow to $100 billion per year by 2020, but governments had pledged a total of only $10.3 billion as of late 2019. A further $10 billion in pledges was secured by the end of 2020. Although some view the Paris Agreement as a crucial step toward mobilizing national and international action to mitigate global emissions, it will hardly do anything directly to reduce human influences on the climate, given the 100% reduction needed to stabilize the carbon dioxide concentration. The aggregate impact of the reductions pledged by all nations would reduce global emissions by less than 10% in 2030. These efforts are quite feeble compared to a requirement of zero emissions by 2075, let alone by 2050. This was clear even in 2015, when the agreement was signed. It is even more apparent now, as can be seen in Figure 12.4. The modest reductions in 2030 emissions that would be achieved if all Paris pledges were met in 2030 are a long way from what would be needed to see emissions vanish. Developments since 2015 have only strengthened the sense that the Paris Agreement is unlikely to even slow the growth of human influences on the climate, let alone reduce them. Here's the glum assessment of the UN's Emissions Gap Report of 2019, issued just before the Paris signatories convened that December at the COP25 conference in Madrid to review their progress. The summary findings are bleak. Countries collectively failed to stop the growth in global GHG emissions, meaning that deeper and faster cuts are now required. It is evident that incremental changes will not be enough, and there is a need for rapid and transformational action. Figure 12.5 from the report shows the recent history of emissions from the top signatories of the Paris Agreement. Although the G20 countries, currently those with per capita GDP greater than or equal to Mexico's, are on track to meet their 2020 pledges, they are projected to fall short in aggregate in 2030. In particular, as of the end of 2019, the U.S. was on track to achieve its pledge of a 17% reduction in 2020 relative to 2005, but will miss its 2030 goal without further policy changes. Japan was on track to meet its pledge of a 15% reduction by 2030, but it's building more coal-fired power plants following the Fukushima nuclear power disaster. The EU, which accounts for less than 10% of today's emissions, has pledged a 40% reduction by 2030 and has legislated a 100% net reduction by 2050. In contrast, almost all high-emitting developing economies are expected to increase emissions significantly by 2030. China and India are building coal-fired power stations that will double and triple their emissions, respectively, while Russia, the world's fourth largest emitter, also proposes investments that will increase its emissions substantially. In our globalized world, emissions restraints would have to be in place everywhere to be effective, or else carbon-intensive activities like heavy manufacturing will simply shift to regions without restraints. And we have yet to see serious international consideration of the emissions embodied when a low-emitting country imports goods manufactured in a high-emitting country. The EU has proposed a carbon-based border tax to level the emissions playing field for all countries and keep their industries competitive. But even if all of the member countries agree to that in principle, I guess that establishing the details of implementation will lead to prolonged and contentious, and ultimately failed, negotiations. The fact that any effective policy must cover all of the major emitting nations around the globe is the nub of the challenge in reducing human influences. The prosperous countries have the resources to reduce their emissions while maintaining their prosperity, and many have started on that path. There are uncertainties about how far they can or will go, in part because there will be costs and disruption in creating a minimally emitting society. Yet the developing world has a host of far more immediate and pressing problems facing it, including adequate energy, transportation, housing, public health issues like clean water and sanitation, and education, not to mention recovery.